Hello, this is Andy Bomick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the March 2025 Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article that I didn't get to last week, about the documentary about Jeff Buckley, and then an article about the Australian band NXS, and a classic album review of Daydream Nation by Sonic Youth. And I begin with the article about Jeff Buckley, the documentary titled Coup de Grâce. An officially endorsed Jeff Buckley documentary is finally here, but how full is the picture. Difficult job it's been looking at the face and listening to hashtag Jeff Buckley music for the last 6 years, reflected director Amy Berg on Instagram in December as she confirmed the release of her film It's Never Over, Jeff Buckley. The long-awaited full-length documentary on the late artist who drowned in 1977 debuts this month at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah. It's showing alongside other tempting music docs, including Questlove's Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, and early 70s portrait One-to-One, John and Yoko. According to Buckley's estate gatekeeper, Jack Bookbinder, the film has been in the works since Berg finished her 2015 Janis Joplin documentary, Little Girl Blue. Amy spent a good chunk of her life immersed in Jeff's work and building a relationship with Mary Gubert, Buckley's mother, says Bookbinder. She's got a great reputation and trust was established. Buckley's estate also sought the opportunity to set the record straight. My sole purpose for appearing in the film is to say there was no foul play, no drugs or alcohol in Jeff's system, no suicide, says Bookbinder's colleague, former tour manager Gene Bowen. Rolling Stone's story, just days after Jeff died, should have published the autopsy, but instead left an air of mystery. Jeff only went into the Mississippi River because he saw the beauty of the water and went for it. It's Never Over, named after a lyric in Buckley's Grace album, ballad, Lover, You Should Have Come Over, promises previously unreleased live footage, voice messages, and sketchbooks, plus animated sequences. But Berg's comment, difficult job, is reflected in the experience of Blakely drummer and film interviewee Parker Kindred, who has seen the finished version. Here's a little bit of that song, You Should Have Come Over, by Jeff Buckley, from his album Grace.
Door, I see the rain fall upon the funeral mourners, parading in the wake of sad relations as their shoes fill up with water.
There's great footage, like Jeff playing downtown NYC, Cubbyhole, Cine, and pivotal moments, like Jeff meeting Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, says Kindred. But if I told the story, I'd talk to more musicians who Jeff hung out with and leaned on. I'd want to know more about the rumor that Jimmy Page might have produced Jeff's second album. This is more of a movie about relationships with women, from his mother, Mary Gubert, to first girlfriend, Rebecca Moore, to Joan Wasser, a.k.a. Joan as Police Woman. It starts with three women crying, which sets the tone. Other key voices, including Columbia A&R man Steve Berkowitz, the late Hal Wilner, and Buckley's aunt Peggy Hagburn, were significantly not invited to contribute. Also absent is former manager Dave Laurie, who is sacked by Gubert following Buckley's death. I'm the only one that knew Jeff that well during the 4 years we were together, Laurie claims. Neither Gubert nor any spokesperson for the film could be reached for comment. No one will ever get it right because we all have our own perspectives on the person, says Bowen, who adds, there are beautiful things in the film, like Jeff's sense of humor. No one could do impersonations like Jeff, from Bugs Bunny to Cher. It's all heartbreaking, Kindred concludes. Jeff was so young, and he had so many layers. The way the film goes to emotional places, all relationships torture us. I just want to know what made Jeff live. And now, the article about the band NXS, titled Never Tear Us Apart. From unlikely far-flung beginnings, NXS rose to conquer the world, enamoring Springsteen, The Stones, and Chrissy Hyde, before singer Michael Hutchinson's tragic demise. A reissue of their Watershed, Listen Like Thieves, reveals a Swiss Army band, joined at the hip, but Mojo find some wounds still raw. We floundered for years, they tell John Azulwood. And here's a little bit of that NXS song, Never Tear Us Apart.
Don't ask me what you know is true. Don't have to tell you I love your precious heart. I was standing, you were there. Two worlds collided and they could never tear us apart.
It is the evening of March 30th, 1981. Los Angeles is at its most balmy. Ray Masaryk, once a door, but still a consultant, is slumped on his couch watching the newish in concert program Rock and Roll Tonight. British newcomer Simple Minds pass him by, and he's been down the Eric Clapton road before. But when he sees NXS, the little-known Australians, promoting their third album, the number 46 U.S. hit, Shabu Shaba, Masaryk is galvanized. He swaps his armchair for his car and drives to the Pasadena studio, where the show is filmed. Accidentally blocking the studio's green room is Andrew Farris, soon to become NXS's chief songwriter, but always the middle of the band's three Farris brothers. He said I had to come. Then he asked if I would mind moving so he could talk to Michael. That's Michael Hutchins, NXS's sweet-natured Herman Hesse reading singer, who, having partly grown up in Hollywood and Hong Kong, is more worldly than his Sydney bandmates. He's blessed and ultimately cursed with a near feral sexuality. I listened in, Ray said. He'd never seen anyone else with Jim Morrison's charisma. Never. That's when I truly realized there was something happening. Before the end of the decade, NXS's rare melange of pop catchiness, rock power, funk funkiness, ska jerkiness, new wave drive, and Hutchins would make them the biggest band in the world. It began, not really began, more started out, in 1971 when school friends Kirk Pinnegley and Tim, the oldest Ferris, made acoustic music as Guinness. Pingdaly graduated to saxophone. I thought I'd pick up more girls, but it seems quite a few could resist a sax man. Plus guitar, backing vocals, and tending of the NXS archive. Meanwhile, Hutchins, Andrew Farris, and Gary Beers were part of Dr. Dolphin. Beers would have been an electrician, but for color blindness, he began to play bass for a bet. I lost the bet, but won the lottery. The two factions merged, and by 1977, they had added John, the youngest Ferris, to become the Ferris Brothers, all self-taught bar Tim Farris's classic guitar lessons. Fiercely ambitious, Tim Farris would become NXS's most energetic promoter. Tim told us we'd be the biggest band in the world. You'd buy three left shoes off him, chuckles Pingley. Inconveniently, the Farris parents, Dennis and Jill, promptly relocated to Perth, Australia's most isolated city. Schoolboy John went too. The rest of the band left jobs and partners to follow. It really began in 1978 as the sun set over a beach in Perth's northern suburbs. We were sat in a line, six crows looking out at the ocean, smoking a friendly little doobie, remembers John Farris. We were kids, but our hearts were pure. We all said, A, we want to be as known as the Beatles. B, we think we can do that. And C, the best way to do it is to stay together. We sealed the covenant, and that was it. We were never going to break up. It would never be five against one. Even thinking about it makes me feel emotional. The kids were all right. the sextet was only split by Hutchinson's presumed suicide in 1997. Not one of these now 60-somethings doubts that if Hutchins were alive, they would be together today. By June 1979, the Farris brothers were back in Sydney, rising through the world's most brutal pub circuit. The Angels, Cold Chisel, and Midnight Oil ruled this particular roost, a domestic scene for domestic consumption. Tightly rehearsed, road-hardened, and musically genre-busting, the Farris brothers were regulars at the Royal Antler, mere meters from where Tim Farris now lives in the northern Sydney suburb of Narrabeen. Today, there would be no legal way you could fit 1,500 people in, but they did, he grimaces. It was so fucking hot and so packed, it was like that alien scene where the walls pulsate. Condensation rained off the roof. Everyone smoked, the amplifiers were melting. Your eyes were melting, and you were trying to play. After famously securing an encore, then supporting the Angels, they were briefly picked up by Midnight Oil's management, who instigated the name change to NXS, and then by the booking agent Chris Murphy, an abrasive, ruthless, workaholic, obsessive, who shared the band's ambition and understood that to fulfill it, they would have to leave Australia. After two Australian top 30 albums featured the eclectic material with which they'd conquered the Sydney circuit, Murphy signed NXS to different labels in different territories. People wouldn't care about a band signed by their faraway Sydney office, explains Pengilly. But if they signed us themselves, we'd be a priority. Serendipitously, a cable music television station called MTV had recently started broadcasting in America. We put two and two together to overcome the tyranny of distance, says Andrew Farris. We made a heap of entertaining, low-budget videos and handed them out like free bus tickets. After recording Shabu Shaba in Australia, they promoted it in America, playing their first U.S. date in San Diego 5 days before Rock and Roll Tonight. The One Thing was in heavy MTV rotation and became our first American top 30 single. So we were getting mobbed in college towns, laughed Pinnacle. They had Liftoff. There's a little bit of that song, The One Thing, by NXS. The longer the U.S. jaunt, the more likely the cost of transporting band, crew, and equipment from Sydney would be recouped. So they toured incessantly, the heartland as well as the coast. Whether headlining or supporting acts, including Adam Ant, Adam Arsehole, we called him, quips Pingelly. The three brothers and three best friends were young, hungry, and full of piss and vinegar, reminisces Beers. You don't go home, you don't play golf, explains Andrew Forrest of the Road Warrior Years. You're with the same people, but we could cope with that level of isolation. That was a determining factor in NXS's success. We did things that were too hard for other people. Other Australian bands got the quits, notes Tim Ferriss. They couldn't handle the distance. Their commitment wasn't really there. Album member four, The Swing, distilled what had gone before. Its platinum U.S. success opened more doors. Enter producer Chris Thomas, who'd worked on The Beatles, Dark Side of the Moon, and critically since the Ferris Brothers covered early Roxy Music, For Your Pleasure. Thomas thought NXS were the best live act he'd seen, but he also thought their records hadn't reflected that. Working with him was a learning curve, explains Tim Ferriss. He told stories about Chrissy Hyde chasing John Lydon on a ledge at the Townhouse Studio where there was a four-story drop. He internationalized us, adds Beers. He taught us it's about the song, not the individuals making it. He demanded stronger songs, which built on the groove thing we were making our own. When we thought we'd finished Listen Like Thieves, he sent Andrew and Michael away. They came back with What You Need. They toured down a Rolling Stone, they turned down a Rolling Stone cover when the magazine wanted only Hutchins. But the touring remained relentless, and 1985's Listen Like Thieves went double American platinum. Here's a little bit of that NXS song, What You Need. Make the leap to stadiums, there was one adjustment required. All six members had written songs in assorted combinations, but all four singles from The Swing and Listen Like Thieves, biggest two, were by Andrew Forrest and Hutchins. There was a conversation on a tour bus in West Germany. It was a bit cheeky, admits Andrew Forrest, who wrote the music before Hutchins added lyrics. But we suggested we'd write Kick. We said, it's not because we're greedy or selfish, but we're on the precipice of breaking big time. If you let us give you the best songs, we can come up with. We're going to do it. To Michael and I's surprise, the band made a very clever intellectual decision. They said, okay. Nobody was thwarted. It was win-win. We knew it was coming, shrugs Beers. Two of the world's best songwriters getting off on writing with each other? No-brainer. Our motto was always, whatever's clever. The pill was sweetened by Murphy's allocating the writers only 50% of the publishing income. The remaining 50% would be shared by all six. It headed off problems, adds Beers. You put your mark on a song, you tour your ass off promoting it, so you should be rewarded. Then came Kick. Every album you're going, please Lord, let this be the one, laughs Pengilly. We knew Kick was special. So special, in fact, that their American label offered $1 million for it, but only if they scrapped it and made a different album. Mr. and Mrs. I Know Everything from the record company didn't like it, says John Ferris, still aghast. NXS rejected the $1 million, toured extensively again, cultivated those who got Kick at their labels, and carried on regardless. Again, they were right. In 1987, Kick took them to the stratosphere. X-1990 kept them there. They had, by any reasonable yardstick, made it. Sometimes it turned us into gibbering wrecks, says John Ferris. But guys such as Mick Jagger started sniffing around, asking how we'd done it from an Australian suburb. I loved it, smiles Beers, and I miss it. Hutchins, born to be a star, and other unlikely but true cliches, loved it too. He could do things I couldn't, admits Andrew Farris. He bought a fully restored 1960s Centron, drove it from one city to another, left the keys in the ignition, and walked off. I've never known anyone like that. John Ferris and Hutchins lived together in Hong Kong, the Antidean odd couple. We're talking really flashy here, remembers John Ferris. There were people outside selling rats and snakes. We were seven floors up with no elevator. I had a mattress on the floor, but the centerpiece of the kitchen, no bigger than someone's laundry room, was a cardboard box. On top of it was a camping stove on which we'd cook up 10-minute noodles. We'd sit watching junks pass by on the South China Sea. We loved each other. As it so often does, success breeds restlessness. After X, Chris Thomas was out, the band bought their own studio playground, Rhinoceros, and crafted their most musically adventurous statement, Welcome to Wherever You Are. Success enabled us to do whatever the fuck we wanted, explains Pengilly, of most of its makers' preferred NXS album. It could have been really smart to remake Kick and X for the rest of our careers, argues Andrew Farris, but we turned left at the fish and chip shop. The years of toil were taking their toll. Families were falling apart, even if the band remained solid. We should have taken a proper break after X, speculates Tim Ferris. Instead, we took a break our manager could live with, which wasn't very long. For all that welcome to wherever you are, reinvigorated them musically. The slide towards tragedy began one August 1992 night when Hutchins and his girlfriend, supermodel Helena Christensen, cycled to her Copenhagen home. He fell in an altercation with a taxi driver and his head smashed on the curb. "It sounds suspicious and weird to me," muses John Ferris. "Did the taxi driver really stop and get out to attack him? Surely, if you're driving a taxi, there's a flow of traffic behind you." Helena was a lovely woman, Tim Ferris adds, and she was great for Michael. He should have been put in an induced coma to give his brain a chance to heal. "It changed everything," sighs Beers, "a horror point. Our brother was hurting." Hutchins, the uber-sensualist, lost his sense of taste and smell. Worse, the kind, gentle soul became prone to violent rages. For the next album, Full Moon, Dirty Hearts, Hutchins overruled Murphy's suggestion that they record in Jamaica. Instead, the clan trekked to the Italian island of Capri, a summer tourist hotspot, but almost deserted in winter. "Going into the studio was the dumbest thing we could have done after Michael's injury," argues Beers. After the first session hadn't gone so well, producer Mark Opitz went to ask if we could cancel. "They just said, 'You know who owns this studio, don't you?'" Mark came back very pale. Meanwhile, the now erratic Hutchins had been seduced by grunge. "Michael wasn't thinking clearly," laments Pengilly. "He strongly argued that if we didn't jump on the Nirvana Seattle fad, we were fucked. It's my least favorite album, but it would have gone in a very different direction without Michael's brain fuck." "Michael was drinking heavily," says Tim Ferris. "He was so unhappy, and we couldn't work out why. We were astonished and sad." Voluntarily, they toured Full Moon, Dirty Hearts in smaller venues. The perception that NXS were an involuntary pub band, again, would never quite be shaken. By 1996, when the band reconvened to record Elegantly Wasted, after rehearsing at Hutchinson's four-bedroom villa in the south of France, Murphy was gone. Andrew Farris was living in London, and Hutchins was in a tabloid catnip relationship with Paula Yates and writing his most personal lyrics. "He said the only place he felt safe was with us," says Andrew Farris. 1 in 20 Canadians own an NXS album, so they decamped to Vancouver with Bon Jovi Aerosmith producer Bruce Fairbairn. "Michael was back to normal," insists Pengilly. Others disagree, although they all enjoyed carousing with Brian Adams. While his life with Paula had become so insane, he couldn't leave his house, it would never have split us. "Maybe we should have gone back with Chris Thomas," wonders Beers. "It wasn't a fun record to make." In November 1997, NXS were in Sydney rehearsing for their first Australian tour in half a decade at the hangar-sized ABC, the Australians' equivalent of the BBC studios. Sometimes he was back to his old self, and once he wheeled a big black Harley Davidson around the studio, says Tim Ferris. But you'd see him on the phones screaming and yelling. Pengilly lived close to the Ritz-Carlton in Double Bay, where Hutchins was staying, and usually drove the pair into ABC. He was in a great space, but not on the 22nd, since Pengilly had stayed over at a friend's. Tim Ferriss, NXS's resident cricket maven, was watching Australia play New Zealand on a tiny portable television when a news flash announced Hutchinson's death. "We were, what the fuck," remembers Pengilly. "All hell broke loose. But suicide? Really?" "Michael and I had become closer than we'd been in a long time," smiles Beers. "The hurt was deep. I blocked it out, drinking and partying. I don't know what happened. I don't think about it too much, and I don't agonize. I feel sorry that this gentleman, sweetheart, and wonderful person is not watching his daughter grow up. If he had his time again, I'm sure there'd be a different outcome." "It changed my life," says John Ferriss. "I responded very badly. I was lost. Mom had passed. I just found out what my wife had been doing while I was on tour. And when Michael didn't die in his sleep, age 93, it was too much. I went to Thailand and hit the bottle." At the funeral, Andrew Ferriss slipped a pen into his songwriting partner's coffin. "Out of respect, my way of saying thank you and I love you." John Ferriss still has a reoccurring dream. "We're backstage. We get the call to go on stage. I say, 5 minutes, Mikey. He replies, I can't come on. I won't be singing, but I'm here in spirit with you. Then I wake up. For a moment, I've forgotten he's dead." Soon after Hutchinson's passing, Andrew Ferriss found himself on a plane with Angus Young. He asked how long AC/DC took to get over Bon Scott's death. 3 weeks, Young replied. "We floundered for years," states Pengilly. The lost band stumbled into continuing. There were dates with singers, including Cold Chisel's Jimmy Barnes, Noiseworks' John Stevens, Northern Ireland's Cisrin Greben, and once Terence Trent D'Arby, until 2005. Then, according to John Ferriss, they approached U.S. reality TV titan Mark Burnett with an idea: Rockstar NXS, a televised competition to find the next NXS singer. To avoid Hutchins' comparisons, a female singer seemed likely. Another candidate was J.D. Fortune. Pengilly remembers the consensus. "No way that guy's ever going to be our singer. He's such a dick." Fortune won, of course. The almost wholly pre-written Switch album was recorded in 3 turbocharged weeks, and the tour assuaged many doubts. "The exposure gained us a generation of fans who didn't know us with Michael," trills Andrew Ferriss. "People love J.D.," accepts Tim Ferriss. "But there were nights when he was terrible. Michael canceled 2 shows out of thousands. With J.D., there were shows that should have been canceled. I'm as proud of Switch as any NXS album," states Beers. In 2025, Listen Like Thieves is the latest reissue in an extensive program, reminding people what they loved or what they missed. Although Tim Ferriss struggles to play guitar after a boating accident, "My finger had been sewn back onto my hand. Is there one last lap in the tank?" "The door is ajar," says John Ferriss. "It's an open door," says Andrew Ferriss. "I would never rule it out. My passion is still there," says Tim Ferriss. I'd be happy, says Beers, a resident of Los Angeles, for the past 2 decades. We've discussed it. People are open. We've still got a lot to say. The backstory became bigger than the music, but that's turning around now. As if to prove his point, their career-spanning compilation, The Very Best, has just completed its 11th year in the Australian Top 100. No, absolutely no, says Pengelly. As Tim had promised, we became the world's biggest band. I am fulfilled. Look, concludes Tim Ferriss, what happened to Michael was a tragedy. But the NXS story isn't. Michael used to say that all he wanted was for our music to matter. We achieved that. Here's a side article, What You Need, NXS Between the Hits, selected by John Azlewood. On a Bus, from NXS Deluxe, 1980. The first album's first track was hardly a template, but it did offer pointers. Dominated by Of Their Time keyboards and Hutchinson's world-weary vocals, it really was about a bus ride. It was irresistibly catchy, but almost impossible to pin down, genre-wise. And here's the NXS song, On a Bus. Another NXS song between the hits titled Underneath the Colors, from Underneath the Colors, Deluxe, 1981. The second album's title track was arguably the first great Andrew Ferriss, Michael Hutchins moment. Unusually for NXS, this examination of social conditioning oozed threat. They had never been this slinky before, though the NXS feel was being felt. Here's the song, Underneath the Colors, by NXS. Another NXS song between the hits, Don't Change, from Shabu Shaba, 1983. Their breakthrough moment in the U.S. was so beloved by Bruce Springsteen that he covered it. It passed Britain by, but their sound had expanded. Hutchins was full of joy. See no evil in all directions, and they truly grooved. And here's the song, Don't Change, by NXS. ¶¶ another NXS song, Between the Hits, Red Red Sun, from Listen Like Thieves, 1985. A rare collaboration between the younger Ferris brothers. It crashed and clattered along like the early Saints records the band so admired. John's lyric detailed a long-distance relationship where the sun he's watching set is working up his love. And here's the song Red Red Sun by NXS. Another NXS song titled Guns in the Sky from Kick 1987. Clocking in at a snappy 141 seconds, Kick's opener established the sound which would take NXS to stadiums. But in every other sense, it was a real red herring. Hutchinson's attack on the U.S.'s Strategic Defense Initiative was brutal and uncompromising. And here's the song by NXS, Guns in the Sky.
See the sound, it crashes in. Take your hands and raise them up into the air that's all around you. Now bring them down like a clock at two. And shake your head, you know what to do. They wanna put guns in the sky. Someone out there.
And another NXS song between the hits titled Building Bridges from Elegantly Wasted 1997. Where has our innocence gone? Asked Kay Hutchins on the final track of his final album. It's a muted, swagger-free end, especially poignant in view of what was to happen. This seductive air of reflection might have been the way ahead. And here's a little bit of the song Building Bridges by NXS. Classic album review for this week is Daydream Nation by Sonic Youth, 1988, Artful Noisniks, Sprawling Double Set, Awash with Inspired Avant Rock Squall, Fractured Classic Rock, and Ineffable NYC Cool. Sonic Youth surfaced in a New York reverberating with Clanging, No Wave, and Bustling Post-Punk Groove in 1981. The eerie chaos of 1985's Bad Moon Rising remains a masterpiece, while the artfully damaged pop and beautiful drone of 1986's Evolve and 1987's Sister charmed rocked audiences. But it was Daydream Nation, a sprawling yet concise double set, which would prove their breakthrough. At their most anthematic, their most confident, and their most iconic, the youth gleefully twisted classic rock archetypes into thrilling new shapes, which would themselves prove profoundly influential on the groups that followed. Sonic Youth began woodshedding new material, jamming on riffs, stretching their ideas to the outer limits via extended instrumental passages, where once their music had slalomed recklessly toward thrilling, explosive climaxes, these new songs had a more complex structure, segueing between different sections and moods with a dramatic panache. Also, they were long, too long to be contained on a single vinyl album. A double album just meant more Sonic Youth music out there, says Paul Smith, the youth's label boss, which was exactly what I wanted. The riffs and guitar heroics of Daydream Nation betrayed the band's renewed interest in classic rock as refracted by contemporaries Dinosaur Jr. and Mudhoney. Indeed, Jay Masis's Marshall Stack Squall was such an influence upon the group that Thurston Moore penned the album's opener, Teenage Riot, in tribute. And here's a little bit of that song, Teenage Riot, by Sonic Youth. Lyrics wreathe day-to-day existence with a mysterious low-rent glamour, posting the group as stoned wizards in rock tees, wandering bum trash halls and totaling amps, scored by a symphony of inspired amp damage, electrifying guitar abuse, and their most accessible songs yet. The album was a readily acclaimed triumph. I equate the experience of recording the album with innocence, says producer Nicholas Sansono. And although no one knew it at the time, the success of this album marked the end of innocence for independent music. In the years that followed, Sonic Youth's underground would make a valiant assault on the mainstream, which many wouldn't survive. But, much like the other album Sansono recorded in the summer of 1988, Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Millions, Daydream Nation remains a visionary statement which still sounds a little like the future. There's a little bit of the song, The Sprawl, from Sonic Youth from their album Daydream Nation.
To the extent that I wear skirts and cheap nylon slips, I've gone native. I wanted to know the exact dimensions of hell. Does this sound simple? Fuck you. Are you for sale? Does fuck you sound simple enough? This was the only part that turned me on, that he was candy all over. Come on down to the store. You can buy us more. Come on down to the store.
And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the March 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an interview with Donovan in the late 1960s and some of the top 50 greatest songs from Paul Weller, who played with Style Council and The Jam, and a classic album review of Pretzel Logic by Steely Dan. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long. And keep rocking.